Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Gianna Rayburn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Hi, Samantha. Welcome to the What to Read podcast.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
So happy to have you here. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So my name is Samantha, and Narrow is my debut novel. I'm also a literary agent, where I've been at George Borchardt Literary Agency for the last 15 years.
That's amazing. So we're going to talk about being an agent, be a debut author, but also talk about Marrow and what was the source of inspiration, because I really love the pitch that your publicist shared with us. I was like, oh my gosh, we need to talk about it. Because at first glance, Marrow doesn't sound like it. And I'm like, oh no, we got to talk about this. So first things first, let's talk about Marrow and what is the elevator pitch? Because it's something, but obviously there's more to the story.
Yes. So the elevator pitch, I mean, to me, I feel like what Marrow is about is it's about longing. In the novel, Una wants to be a mother. That's what she's longing for. But I think it's hoping to reckon with longing in a larger sense and sort of what longing can lead us to do, how it can take us places we never thought we'd go, how it can make us bargain with the universe. Yeah, there's a power in that kind of want. And that's what I was trying to get at in writing Marrow.
Yeah. And I think Marrow, it's about a reckoning of like going back home in some ways, like after at one point not feeling the belonging and not part of it. And the decisions you make based on that. I was thinking about it in my own personal life. I had a traumatic childhood and a lot of different things. And I made the decision at 18, like going out to, in her case, she was kicked out, but I was like actually left the house. And choices that we make based on those things that we're seeking. Like I didn't have this part of things. So I'm seeking something out in a way to heal that child, the inner child that you had, and actually provide that. But unfortunately, life doesn't work that way, that you're just like, I'm going to have a child and I'm going to give them everything they want, they didn't have. Obviously, there's twists and turns. And I think that's part of Una's journey is like coming back home and trying to consider, like figure it out and figure out that life doesn't work just because you long something. Yeah. It's going to happen. I think they sell this ability. It's like, if you want it, you're going to get it.
Right.
And it doesn't work that way. And I think it segues with a lot of conversations about IVF, fertility, childbearing, having a kid, not wanting to have a kid. I chose to be child-free, but there's the other side of like having a kid, having a relationship, being single by their choice, being a single this, being, like what are the choices? If it's your ex, it's a lot of conversations because we're trying to, in many ways, undo what we did when we had with our childhood and try to do it differently, but then life doesn't work the way we wanted to work.
Yes. No, I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah. So talk to us about like your take on in the like the research when you were actually building the story. What was the process like for this?
Yeah. So part of what led me to writing Marrow and led me to writing about infertility in general was my own experience with infertility. My husband and I tried for almost 2 years to have a baby on our own. It was not happening. And I found that really challenging for a number of reasons. The hard part, obviously, is that I want a baby and I don't have one. But I think also just what you were saying about how you have this idea that almost it's like if you want something and you work hard enough, you can have it. And I think also for women, there's this idea that like becoming a mother is your birthright. Like you are owed this or something by the universe. This is like what your body was meant to do. And I wanted there to be something I could do to fix the situation, to be able to like will my body into doing what I wanted it to do. And I ended up experimenting with a whole bunch of things, things that were more and less on a spectrum of the quote unquote science. And I think over the course of that research, which wasn't really research for this novel, it was research for my life, I learned a lot. And then I think I saw the dark side of some of that. I think there's a lot of power in trying things that are not part of Western medicine and with things and seeing what could help and what doesn't. But I think there's also a lot out there that is meant to be predatory, that is to take advantage of people and women in particular in desperate situations. And I saw a lot of that in my own research for my life. And so I think I was also inspired by that and wanting to sort of take that on, at least in a fictional sense.
Yeah, I can relate to it. I think in some ways it's not just fertility. I think it's wellness. It's a big business. Ideas of purpose, idea of meaningful life and what you're supposed to be doing. And it goes in the spectrum. And like, I experienced similar things and not in the fertility space, but I've experienced it in the wellness space and the mental illness and the healing your inner child. And a lot of it, some stuff work. And some stuff did not work. And some stuff was snake oil. And some stuff was actually like really powerful shifts. But there's somehow we're bombarded with the idea that if it doesn't work, there must be something wrong with you. And we internalize that into like out of the problem. But when something happens, something works, and you, the other person is the one who was a miracle. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the disconnect, because it was like, you're the problem, you're hurting yourself, you're gaslighting yourself. And yet at the same time, like, what's the solution? And again, we're taught beliefs that are not real. Like, there must be something wrong with you. It's like, well, that's not true. And it's learning to trust your intuition, your inner voice, to say like, but that's not the facts. Those are emotional, and those are other people marketing that are selling you something that they want you to be. They might be predatory or not. And I think it's helpful to hear other people's voices and other people's experiences, but also understanding that your experience might be unique, and yeah, that's part of the journey.
Yeah. I've always been sort of fascinated by cults of all kinds. And I found that, I find that thinking interesting, and I feel like a lot of insular communities, no matter like what they're about, it feels like some of that thinking, that groupthink, starts appearing. In the infertility space, when I was going through it, one place I turned was social media, and there are like infertility influencers, for lack of a better word. I mean, I don't think a lot of these women are doing it to like monetize their own struggles. It's not so much about that. I'm sure it is an outlet for their pain. But as a result, I feel like when you start following enough people, and some of them have like really a lot of followers, and you start realizing like connections between people, and who, you know, that they know each other, and that there is, and a lot of the same things get repeated, and certain sources become sort of, I don't know, authority figures, like authority voices that are not doctors, that are not. And yet that it's complicated, because part of the reason that emerges is because there's such a frustration with the doctors who are disregarding women and disregarding their pain and maybe not listening, and maybe there are other solutions, et cetera, et cetera. But I find that, I don't know, that interesting. It is, like that groupthink emerges in these spaces. Yeah.
Yeah, we're seeing also in the wellness space. I have an interview with Amy LaRocca. She did a whole nonfiction about the wellness industry and specifics. And we see that over, and like not just in the fiction space and the cult space and influencers. I think I just had a conversation with a therapist about this. And it's like, there is something to be said about that you're supposed to have a character arc. You're supposed to have an inciting incident that you got to story. We monetize story time on TikTok. We monetize the idea of like, I had something to tell you, and my story is value, or my story is valid, and stuff like that. And there's power in that, but there's also power in be like actually discernment of like, is it really true? Is this the real thing? Because we see that groupthink in the anti-vaxxer space, or we see it like in the spaces where like there's an idea like, oh, this is, we saw this, and we trust this charismatic person who is telling us this story. And then it's like, it's the gospel. Yeah. And it's like actually taking a step aside. And it's not easy to be the person who's discerning, because we as human beings, we want to belong. We want to be a part of the crew. There's safety numbers. It's not safe to be alone. So it's like, how do you interact with this world? And how do you interact in this post-pandemic world where it's post-capitalist, where it's a lot of the things are technology has improved, but at the same time, we're bombarded with so much information. And everyone feels that their story is just as valid. It's the most valid story in the world.
Main character energy.
Yes, I think main character energy is probably what defines the 2020. Awesome. So let's talk about your journey, because when did you get started writing this book? Like, was it pre-pandemic, or was it always in the back of your head? Like, maybe there's a story here to tell. I know it's interesting because you're an agent, so you have the other side experience. So,
yeah, I mean, I've been writing for as long as I can remember, honestly. I wrote in college, and were mostly very good short stories. I was trying to write a novel. I speak to my fascination with my cult, a novel about Jonestown, for years after college. That didn't ever really quite come together in the way that I wanted. I did not find a home. And then in the midst of the pandemic was when I was going through infertility. I had already started working with my agent for the Jonestown novel, which clearly wasn't going to sell, which in retrospect is a good thing. But at the time, I think I was not only like looking for a place to process what I was going through with IVF, but also looking for like something new to think about and work on. Yeah. It wasn't this other book. And so I could stop thinking about whether or not like it would find a home.
Yeah. I love this idea of like, sometimes we had to set aside projects. Again, it's like, yeah, like we're supposed to have a one-way solution, one thing. And the reality is the longing, sometimes the project doesn't match where we are in the trends. And you probably know this as an agent. It's a lot of it. It's a business when it comes to selling books. And so maybe not right now. Maybe we reconfigure it. Maybe it goes back to during the receipts of the light of day. Maybe reconfigures. And there might be discussions. It might be revisiting for those novels, you know, when the trend is right, when the time is right.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You never know. And then I think a lot of times, honestly, I mean, this is true for me. And I know it's been true for other writers I worked with, which is that sometimes you just outgrow a project too. Like, and then you're big. Like I am. I think Really Great Golden Hero is my first book. I'm really proud of it. I mean, I was proud of the Jonestown novel, but I think mostly it was like a learning experience of how to write a book. I didn't get my MFA. My schooling was really like being an agent and editing with my clients and seeing their genius on the page. And so there was a lot of like learning involved in that first book. And I think it sort of had to go that way for me.
Yeah. So talk to us about being an agent. What does it look like? Because I know there's a lot of questions and you can talk a little bit, just an idea. Like people may be curious what it's like as an agent, make the decision and I know there's a lot of questions how to get an agent. We don't want to go there. But like, what is actually an agent? Because I think it's one of the most important relationships for a writer to have, because they're going to be the advocates for selling the book and actually helping them pre-write. Like, it's the most important relationship in some ways. The publisher can come and go, but the agent typically stays long-term.
I think that's a really important point. Yeah. I mean, I think it is probably like the longest lasting. I mean, you don't know, like sometimes writers do work with their same editor for their career. I think that's becoming less and less common. But it's not entirely impossible. But yeah, I mean, hopefully you are working with your agent for the length of your career. I joined the agency pretty quickly out of college, and I knew I wanted to be in book publishing. I thought after some internships I wanted to do agenting. I loved that you still got to work really closely with writers. You still got to do editorial work, which I wanted to do, but that it was a little bit more like entrepreneurial. It was more about like seeking out the things you wanted to find, the things you wanted to work on. Than it was about like waiting around and hoping the right thing like appeared in your inbox. And there was a little bit more freedom to it. I mean, freedom on a practical sense, because there are some big corporate agencies, but a lot of them like ours are smaller places. There's a corporate culture, let's do a rules.
But also freedom in a sense of like what you want to work on. An editor, by and large, editors are hired to publish specific books. They have a mandate. It's universally true, but most of the time. And they might get a submission for a book that they would love, but, you know, it's not what they were brought on to do, or it's not something that their imprint publishes well. And so they, for that reason, they would have to pass. Whereas I think I always had a lot more freedom to take on the projects that speak to me. And my list has, as a result, been fairly eclectic. I mean, I only do adult fiction and nonfiction, so I can't speak to, not so eclectic, but it involves like every genre ever. But within those categories, I've done poetry, I've done memoirs, I've done history, I've done serious works of investigative journalism, politics, and fiction that runs the spectrum for things that are like very literary, very award winners, all that sort of stuff. And then books that are on the more commercial spectrum, books that are hitting the New York Times bestseller list and being chosen for book clubs and all of that. So I think it flipped a lot of, created a lot of freedom to work on things that I loved, which was what spoke to me.
I love this. So let's talk about submission, because I actually feel like that's a word that was thrown around when you're like character and authors. I'm like, my book is a submission. It's waiting. It depends on what the book sells and what doesn't. What does submission look like from an agent standpoint of view?
Yeah. So for me, what the submission is, largely for me, it's dictated by when the project is ready, because usually I do work pretty hands-on editorially with writers. So we are working, editing the manuscript. It depends on how much it needs to get done and how much time the writer has to edit. Some people are able to drop everything and revise for the next 3 months and the book comes out transformed, and other people need like a year, 2 years. It really depends on what they have going on in their life, how much they're juggling. So when the project is ready, when taking it as far as the two of us can on our own, and I do believe strongly in that, especially for debut fiction writers, I just think the bar is really high and we're not looking to give anybody a reason to say no. So if there's anything we, between the two of us, could think that could be addressed, like I'm trying to get us to think on. So, but when the book is ready, I'm creating a submission list. I usually have been talking the book up and all my lunches and coffees and everything else that I'm having with editors all the time, seeing friends. I've been in this industry 15 years, so chatting, talking about the book with people I think would like it. And hopefully I have a good idea of who would be right for it, both within publishing houses, the imprints, and also like specific editors. I like to run that list by writers in case they have, some folks have been talking with editors at MFA programs or whatever, or they have folks that they are their dream editor. They think they published the last like 10 books they published that the writer loves, and they just really want to make sure their book is seen by this person. So trying to make that process pretty collaborative. I will write my pitch and share that with the author, make that feel collaborative, make sure it's something that feels good to them, feels like a good representation of their work. And then when it's time for submission, we send it out. We see, usually I have a lot of prep calls before, so writers understand. Honestly, the submission process at first, I think, can feel a little anticlimactic, because you do all this work, goes out, and then there's just kind of like nothing for a while. Like how long my lens really depends. It could be a matter of days, or it could be a matter of weeks. In some cases, it's been a matter of months, and the books will sell, and that's great. It really depends. That I think that part could feel pretty, I mean, on my end, I know, it's a very anxious time, but eventually, hopefully, it means it gets a little bit more exciting.
Yeah. So a lot of it's relationship building, from my understanding, like sense of like connecting, knowing, selling the book, or like as someone is like, hey, this might be something of interest. I know this is what you're working on. And be a matchmaker for the author. Yeah, to find. So I would have this question, because I feel like readers will have this. Someone is like, I want to spend all my time reading. How much reading do you get done? Like realistically, is it all this time, or is it actually like you actually have to be more mindful and you have other tasks? Obviously, the relationship building, the talking, the reading with the author, writers. So obviously, what's the realistic all the time reading?
I mean, definitely not all the time, because I do have a lot of other tasks. Yes. A lot of it is, there's
submissions, there's contracts to review, there's royalty statements to review and pay out, there's just a lot of which I'm honestly just nagging people to get back to me about a variety of things. There's a lot of advocacy work. What's even once the book sells, how in the loop a writer needs me to be in terms of like the editorial process, how in the loop I'm depending on the publicity and marketing, what I need to like step in and help with, brainstorm, all that sort of stuff. So I'm continuing to do a, honestly, even post-submission is probably more of my advocacy work than the beginning. Just more of a salesperson role. And so I would say, I mean, I think a lot of agents do that differently. I'm somebody who likes to do things sort of like in little bites. So I read probably like between 50 to 100 pages a day of things. Not about every day. Yeah. I would say other people I think read, maybe they don't read for a few days and then they spend like all Friday reading or something. I think that might be some people, at least in some of the friends I know work.
Yeah. So it's like a reader, like the readers that we're seeing now, they probably are reading more than we are reading in the space of creating, doing the work and stuff like that. So I think it's the idea, I think there's romanticizing, as we talk about, like the idea of like read all day, get a job publishing. And the reality is I've talked to plenty of publisher professionals and they're like, we read less in some ways because we have all these other areas where advocacy, we're project managing, we're selling books, we're talking about books, we're preparing pitches, we're preparing ways to find a way to the book to sell or find a new strategy. And that takes a lot of energy and time and concentration that you may not have to read for fun. You have work reading, which is different than fun reading.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, I feel like the big difference is that it's even those 50 to 100 pages that I'm reading a day, they are pleasure reading. They're usually, I'm reading pretty deeply. Most of it is editorial reading. I will read again, and I will read the sample pages, and those are a little bit faster. But the manuscripts I'm reading from clients, I'm editing those. Like, whenever 50 pages I'm reading a day, it takes a long time.
Yes, it does take a long time. And I think when we start thinking about new authors or people who are looking to get an agent, I think it's important to have someone that you feel comfortable going and talking to and have a relationship. And I think that's what matters, is less about how shiny the object is. It's like, yeah, it's like our representation, but like, do you feel comfortable going to this person and asking questions about royalties, asking questions about editorial? Because that's your job as an advocate. Mm-hmm. And so they need to know, like, what's the story? Yeah. The writer is like, hey, I have life situations happening. I cannot make the deadline. The agent is going to be like trying to massage the message. And so having that open relationship is such an important part of this process.
I think that's true. And I think having somebody you feel, I don't know, like that you vibe with, and it feels a little bit like dating, yeah. Just somebody you feel like is really going to be in your corner. Somebody you feel like you can trust. Somebody I also feel like is going to be responsive. I know that comes up a lot with writers, especially the writers they had taken on who had maybe had a book already out in the world. Are you going to be hearing from this person, or are you only hearing from their assistant? Are they going to be the one reading your book and providing notes, or is that going to be somebody else? Are they going to be answering your email, or are you going to have to be writing like 3 or 4 follow-ups to get a reply? Those are all important things too.
Yeah. Thank you for engaging me with some of those agenting questions.
Okay.
And it's rare that I get to see an agent at this point. So it is exciting. I know we have plenty of authors and listeners and readers who listen to this podcast. And so I think this is a great conversation. So
wonderful.
I want to end this question. I want to end this interview with like some book recommendations, as one does, because the full point is like, what to read next? Like, what do I read after finish tomorrow? So what books do you recommend our listeners to pick up? And it doesn't have to be favorite books. It doesn't have to be related to genre. It can be something different. It can be something that you read for pleasure. But just give us a couple book recommendations.
Yeah. So my favorite books that I read totally for pleasure this year were McConaughey's Wild Dark Shore. Really ambient she's written. Might be her biggest fangirl. I just think she's incredible. I've loved everything from Migrations. I think Once There Were Wolves is maybe my favorite book ever. But I really loved Wild Duck Shore. I just thought it was something that's such a masterclass in tension building and how to like breadcrumb in a mystery so great. I highly recommend it.
I also really love Annie Hartnett's The Road to Tender Hearts, which if you like Kevin Wilson, I think Annie is a great next writer to check out. Her book is so funny and joyful. I think it wrestles with real questions and real struggles, but at the end, it's just like a really fun read that also feels really meaningful at the same time. I love Carrie Cullen, Tense of Death, which I think came out this summer. It's so cool. I just feel like everything she does in this book is so cool and edgy and boundary pushing while also being like really character driven and beautiful. And Megha Majmudar's next book is not out yet, but A Guardian of Thieves. I think Megha is a genius. I absolutely loved her first book. And when it comes out, I feel like I'm in a rush to buy it.
The last one I'll say is if you do like Miro and you haven't had the chance to read Jessamyn Chan's School of Forbidden Mothers, it is brilliant. And I think would probably appeal to, I would hope, with anybody who liked that book would read like Miro. I read Jessamyn's novel and submission many years ago. I was not lucky enough to work with her, but I have been devastated over that ever since. And it's just absolutely, I don't know, stunning. It's so good.
Oh my gosh. I love these recommendations. And I love that you gave us, because you debut, so we hope to see more books for you. But now that we've read your book, you're like, okay, what do I read next? I think you gave us like the next one to go back to. So then we can wait for your next book, as many more to come. Yeah. So Samantha, tell us where to find you online.
My website is SamanthaShea.com. And I am also on Instagram at SD_Shea.
Thank you, Samantha, for being in the show.
Thank you so much. It was so fun to be here.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider rate, review, or subscribe. It's the best way to support the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Bye. Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What You Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyoureadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.